The world is changing at breathtaking speeds, with trends and fads popping up and passing away at breakneck pace. Against that backdrop of nearly constant upheaval, we welcome you to the Sunday Scotch Society. Over delectable, sumptuous scotches and with the occasional good cigar in hand, we have open, honest, and uninhibited conversation about whatever strikes our fancy. Whether it's the critical issue of the day or a deep dive down the rabbit hole, we take it all seriously while having a good time. Join us for a stiff drink and a great conversation. Good day, folks, and welcome to the Sunday Scotch Society. And I am K. Quincy Parker. And today we are flying solo while my usual partner in crime, Matthew B. Kelly, handles some family business. I wish him and his family all the best, and look forward to the next time he and I get to do this again together. I trust that everybody under the sound of my voice has had a fantastic week, and that all things are indeed, as the good book says, working together for your good. This last week has been an interesting one for me, in that I have fallen in love back. Well, let's put it this way. I have fallen back in love with the Bahamas, just as a feature of its geography, its flora, its fauna, the gorgeousness of our beaches, the absolute fantastic nighttime sea breeze, quiet with the sound of crickets and the sea breeze kind of rustling the coconut palm leaves or the sea grape leaves or the soursop tree leaves, whichever leaves that are surrounding your demesne. The sound of the wind off the sea in the leaves with that slightly salty ocean tang in the air at nighttime, with all of the stars that you can see in our night sky. It's just, we live in paradise, y'all. We absolutely live in paradise. And my morning drive is, I've chosen a route that takes me along the edge of the island, along the coast. And the reason that I've chosen that drive, even though it adds 10 minutes to my morning ride, 10 minutes isn't a lot in the grand scheme of things, but the reason that I have chosen that drive is because I get to look out my window and see some of the most gloriously sculpted and painted the coastline of the Bahamas, New Providence, in this instance, where it's either our gorgeous sand fading into the surf, where our aquamarine waters gradually deepen into that coral reef infused blue that is so unique in color. And then you just keep going out to the horizon where the sky, just the cerulean sky with the incredibly puffy white cloud. It's, oh my God. Oh my God, y'all. And then when it's not the sand, you know, that limestone rock that we used to walk on when we were children, and how incredibly different. Maybe it's because we were lighter, but those rocks, when we walked on them as kids, didn't cut our feet. But could you imagine trying to walk on them things now? Anyway, But the sudden juxtaposition of that limestone rock at the shore, and then boom, just aquamarine water. Well, I mean, crystal clear water that looks aquamarine because it's reflecting a beautiful sky. But if you scoop it up, it's like you scooped up a glass of the purest water that you've ever seen. Listen, y'all. We live in paradise. And we're gonna get back to this whole notion of living in paradise. I'm gonna get back to that when I get to what we're gonna talk about together this week. But today, as I am contemplating life in paradise, I have decided to go with an old friend. I think that we may have talked about this once before on the Sunday Scotch Society. But today I'm going to do the entry-level offering from Jameson's Distillery. Jameson's is one of my favorite, but it's one of my favorite Irish whiskeys. As I say, this is the entry level. But Jameson does have a much more distinguished portfolio the deeper you go into it. But those really aren't available here in Nassau. But the Jameson Irish whiskey entry level flagship product is what I am sipping today. And the nose, like most blended whiskeys, you get a sense of sweetness on the nose, yeah? And in addition to the sweetness, there's a little spice in there that is, it's almost like it is giving me hints of cardamom, maybe a little fenugreek. It's not very strong. I mean, the spicy note, and it's not very sharp. So I don't want to give the impression that this is overly complicated. The nose is just, like I say, you get that hint of sweetness, you get a very slight sense of spice. There's almost a honey, you know, that thickness on the nose. And then, of course, there's the alcohol that is definitely there as well. You know, that ethanol burn on your nostrils. But it's not very pronounced. So it's kind of clear and fairly obvious that this particular whiskey is not going to be challenging to drink. It doesn't really get any more complicated than that. And I've had this sitting in my tumbler here for about 10 minutes now, just to kind of let it breathe to see if it'll open up any. And as it has opened up, the nose has just gotten, well, it has just emphasized the sweetness a little more than when I first poured it. So here we go with my first sip for the show of the Jameson Irish whiskey. Yeah. It is definitely a standard. You know, in jazz music, the there are songs that were written. I don't know. So we'll do a little. We'll do a little digression here. There was a place in, I think it was in New York, called Tin Pan Alley. Speaking of standards, that's where this is going. So Tin Pan Alley was a collection of music publishers and songwriters in New York City that dominated sort of pop music in the U.S. in the late 19th and early 20th century. You know, the folks who know people like Cole Porter, and it's like he is kind of one of my favorite of the Tin Pan Alley guys. So the important thing about Tin Pan Alley was that in the mid 19th century, copyright control of melodies was not as strict as it is today, and so you would have publishers who would print their own versions of pop songs at the time, popular songs at the time. And the way this relates to standards is that because these melodies were kind of popular and people would do their own versions of them, they became repertoire that any musician who was a performing musician professionally kind of knew all of these songs. And so it became part of what was known as like the standard repertoire. And so that's where all of these, that's why everybody knows all of these songs. It kind of comes from the freewheeling nature of how music publishing developed in the early to mid 19th century. And what that has done is that has created a sort of pool of music that every musician knows and can perform. And those songs are called standards. So a jazz standard really is only, what that really means is that it's a song that every jazz musician has learned and can perform. And what people do is they take the standards and they put their own little twist on them. They add their own little unique touches. So that Miles Davis's performance, for instance, of a jazz standard like I Got a Crush on You would be different than John Coltrane's version, which would also be different than the Frank Sinatra version, which would be different than the Tony Bennett version, which would be different. Yeah, that's how it goes. So they're all performing the same song. They all know the same song. If they all got together on the stage, somebody would just count off 1, 2, 3, go, and they could all perform the song together because it's a standard. And in the same way, there are certain flavor profiles that are standard when it comes to your blended Irish whiskeys or your blended whiskeys at all, really. And the Jameson entry-level sort of flagship bottle that you could buy for $35 to $40 here in Nassau is a perfect exemplar of hitting all the standards for your Irish whiskey. There's the sweetness that I talked about on the nose. There's the candied fruit that you expect in a good blended Irish whiskey. There's that sort of herbaceous, spicy note that I talked about when I said cardamom. Now that I'm sipping it instead of smelling it, I think that maybe nutmeg is a little more accurate than cardamom. But it's one of those flavor and aroma components that gives you that you know, that sense of that that little spike of what is that? And that is like a standard effect of a good whiskey. There is the, you know, fairly short finish. Doesn't linger very long. But as you sip it, it builds up into a really pleasant, sweet, but not over, it's not sugary. It's like I say, it's almost a candied fruit sweetness, which is not overly sugary, that and so it's not off-putting. And that is the sensation that you're left with as you continue to sip the Jameson. And I mean, there's just nothing wrong with that. It's not a knock you out with uniqueness whiskey. It is not a build a collection around this whiskey. It is a whiskey that you drink when you just want to have a nice drink. You want to have a nice glass of whiskey, and you don't want to think about it. You don't want to try and pair it with anything in particular. You just want to, you want something that you know how it's going to taste. It's going to taste great every time. And, you know, you don't have to freak yourself out about what it is. The Jameson Irish whiskey is your boy. It's the classic in my mind. It's between this and the Bushmill. Which I think is like the classic Irish whiskey taste. Then there are the older and more distinguished offerings, you know, when it comes to Irish single malts or things like the Redbreast 12-year-old, which is, that's almost its own version of a standard. Then you got your Teelings and Tullymore Dew and the rest of them, but it's like what the Jameson has is it is perfectly tuned to give you the right experience if you are new to drinking whiskey or if you are an aficionado. Anywhere from either of those two extremes, you can enjoy a nice sip of the Jameson Irish whiskey. And that's what I'm drinking today. And if you find a bottle of it, pick it up, man. It's something you should definitely have in your collection. Like I say, don't build a collection around it, but you should definitely have it in your collection. So anyway, back to the conversation today. I read something earlier this year that kind of made me, it made me very angry, honestly speaking. And I'll tell you why. When I was growing up, there was a sort of path laid out for the young Bahamian. You go to school, you graduate with good enough grades to get into college, you go to college, you graduate with a degree that helps you get a good job, you get that good job, you work for long enough to be able to put down a down payment on a house or mortgage, you get your house. Once you get your house, you put a wife or a husband, well, a wife in the case of the man, you put a wife in that house. Once you put your wife in that house, then you put some children in that house. And then you spend the next 40 to 50 to 60 years, if God spares your life, building and shoring up that foundation that you've built. But that, I would almost call that the Bahamian dream of like the 1970s and 80s, the 60s, 70s, and 80s. In the 90s and the 2000s, I think the dream has been very significantly altered for some reasons that we'll discuss today. But that is the quote-unquote Bahamian dream, again, only for the purposes of this show today. That is the Bahamian dream that I grew up with. And earlier this year, the Minister of Housing, the Honorable Keith Bell, talked about rent control in the context of affordability for Bahamian homes and Bahamian families. And my theoretical blood pressure spiked. My head practically exploded because it does not seem intuitive and sensible to me to think rent control and home affordability in the same sentence. Rent control, anyway, so I'm not going to jump ahead of myself. What I want to do is kind of skim through with you the article. It was written by Keel Campbell in January of this year in the Tribune. And I'm just going to read you the article. Housing Minister Keith Bell said the government is reviewing the Rent Control Act in response to skyrocketing rental prices and growing concerns over affordability for female families. So, in the House of Assembly in January, Minister Bell said, and I'm going to quote him here, "We have to look at the Rent Control Act to determine what provisions we need to amend and how they're going to adjust it." He talked about how inflation and rising costs for construction, maintenance, and insurance have driven rents to unprecedented levels. Let me just go through the article before I freak out. The Rent Control Act governs how much rent may be charged for certain dwellings or houses whose value does not exceed a specific threshold. Mr. Bell talked about the fact that two-bedroom apartments that once would have rented for $500 now range between $1,500 and $2,000. Anyway, okay, still just going to go through the article. The IMF, that's the International Monetary Fund, highlighted a housing crisis in the Bahamas recently, and we're going to get to that maybe next time that we get together. But Mr. Bell addressed this while he was talking in the House. So what the IMF said was that stagnant wages and surging real estate prices, which have caused rents to rise by 14% between 2012 and 2022, with the average wage only increasing 2%, have disproportionately affected low-income households. I need to take a sip before I again explode. So the report was described by the minister as a reality check. And what he said was, and again, I'm going to quote him here, so I don't want any, you know, backlash here. This is a quote: "No country can ever fully meet the housing demands of its population, particularly for the working and lower classes. Our aim is to do the best we can with the resources we have, and we are taking bold steps to address the challenge." Now, what are those steps? Rent to own, to transition low-income families into home ownership. This program allows renters to make payments over 2 years, with those payments contributing toward a down payment on their home. That program, according to Mr. Bell, has already placed participants in homes in Abaco and will soon be expanded to New Providence. This is the part that made me blow a gasket. Mr. Bell also called on Bahamians to exercise greater financial discipline, citing consumer debt as a key barrier to home ownership. That's the last point that that is reported in Keel's story. But I think that's almost the most important point of the story, because it underlines how government ideology affects policy. Earlier in the story, Mr. Bell talked about the IMF report as a reality check. But two points in particular, which is really one point, but I'll get to it. Two points in particular seem to have escaped the minister, if he is going to say that the housing crisis is somehow connected to consumer debt. In any way, the relevant points are, number one, rents have risen by 14% in a 10-year period, and the average wage during the same period only rose by 2%. There is nothing, just think about that. If the price of rent goes up by 14% and the average salary only goes up by 2%, what does consumer debt have to do with the unaffordability of housing? Now, I'm not saying consumer debt should be ignored, and I'm not saying that it's a good thing, and I'm not saying that it's not relevant at all. But I'm saying that the housing minister, anyway, I'm trying not to talk politics, because this isn't about politics. But then it kind of is about politics. And here's why. What this really boils down to, sorry, in my view, is that true? Do I want to say that? No. What I want to say is this. I think one of the most important factors in this conversation is something that I think may be a little sensitive for politicians to really talk about. And I mean really talk about honestly. So I am going to say it here on the Sunday Scotch Society. The ability of foreigners to buy and own land and housing in the Bahamas is pushing the average Bahamian out of the housing race. They can't compete. It's just that simple. And the fact that prices continue to rise because foreigners can afford the higher prices means that Bahamians, whose salaries are not rising at the same rate as the price of housing and land, simply cannot keep up. And one of the things that I want to talk about on today is why that is. And yes, I'm going to talk about the repeal of the Immovable Property Act. In 1993, the Bahamas repealed the Immovable Property in brackets Acquisition by Foreign Persons close brackets Act, with the enactment of the International Persons Land Holding Act, which aimed to facilitate land ownership by non-Bahamians and companies under their control, beginning in January of 1994. Before the International Persons Land Holding Act was passed, it was illegal for foreigners to own land in the Bahamas. It could not happen. The most they could do was lease land under very limited circumstances. And the point, of course, was for Bahamians to have exclusive access to land ownership in their own country. Some facts. The Movable Property Act was repealed on December 31st, 1993. The repeal was done to facilitate the holding of land by non-Bahamians and companies they control, hence the enactment of the International Persons Land Holding Act, which came into effect, as we said, January 1, 1994. I wish it was 2024. Key elements of the International Persons Land Holding Act. One, it established rules regarding land ownership by non-Bahamians and companies under their control. The act permits non-Bahamians to acquire and hold land or freehold or leasehold title, provided a permit is obtained by the Secretary of the Investments Board, which is also established under the Act, and is registered accordingly. The Act also deals with the registration of certain business leases, the functions and powers of the Investment Board, and other related matters. And the intended effect of the Act was to encourage foreign investment and property ownership in the Bahamas, particularly for second homes. I'm just going to let that rest there for a second. Let me read it again. The intended effects of the Act were to encourage foreign investment and property ownership in the Bahamas, particularly for second homes. To that end, with regard to exemptions, permits are not required for single-family dwellings, vacant land, property acquired by foreclosure, or land acquired by an authorized foreign state. So, let's go back to one of the key elements of the Act, which is what I think the defenders of this Act would argue constitutes a gatekeeper provision, right? So, the Act permits non-Bahamians to acquire and hold land or freehold or lease or leasehold title, provided a permit is obtained from the Secretary of the Investment Board, right? So what they would say is, well, they need a permit, but exemptions include the fact that permits are not required for single-family dwellings, vacant land, property acquired by foreclosure, or land acquired by an authorized foreign state. So, just the fact that they don't need a permit for a single family dwelling or for vacant land or for property acquired by foreclosure, those are the big three. What purpose does requiring the permit serve if these are the exemptions? So, in September of 2023, Pam Burnside wrote a letter to the editor, which I'm going to quote from, because I don't want people to get the impression that this is just Quincy ranting. So Pam says that she was extremely upset by a notice in the newspapers pertaining to quieting of hundreds of acres of land on a family island for a company, not an individual, in the United States. Pam said, and I quote, "What is going on in this country when laws are passed to disenfranchise law-abiding Bahamians of their patrimony? Can this be considered a form of gentrification? How long will it be allowed to continue? Will we remain quiet until we become foreigners in our own land?" Unquote. Pam demanded the reinstatement of the Immovable Properties Act in order to stop what she called carnage. Now, the Immovable Properties Act of 1991 was passed to deter foreigners from owning property free and clear in our archipelago. You know, they were, as I've said earlier, required to lease land if they wished to invest, so that if they decided to just pack up and leave, as Pam points out, at least the country didn't lose ownership of its land assets. So when it was overturned and repealed, according to Pam, local realtors and lawyers were the main agitators for the change, claiming that their business was suffering due to sluggish sales. She points out that in a letter to the editor, I'm going to say that all of this is opinion. Pam argued that the ordinary Bahamian, whether single or family sized, has difficulty even finding apartments to rent because many of these former rental accommodations have been turned into Airbnbs, catering mainly to foreign visitors. Pam says it'd be interesting to know what percentage of the funds raised from such endeavors remain in the country, since these negotiations are also supposedly handled through a foreign-owned agency. Again, I'm just going to let that sit there, just for a second, while I take a sip. In addition, the foreign second and third homeowners are even competing with Bahamians in this regard by renting out their luxury homes on the side, particularly on the family islands, to other high net worth individuals from abroad. The government has finally awakened from their slumber, according to Pam, and are considering ways to collect revenue from such transitions. So, there's that, I guess. But as for the acquisition by a Bahamian of their own plot of land and an actual home of their own, which was often the main goal for young couples of yesteryear, as I said about my own Bahamian dream, the associated costs attached thereto, according to Pam, continue to spiral rapidly out of the range of the ordinary Bahamian's economic reach. And Pam's letter's point is, what is the government going to do about it? When are we, as Bahamians, going to realize not only that this is a problem, but that this is a problem that is exponentially worse as time goes on? When you consider new developments, new construction, I'll talk about New Providence because I haven't done a tour of construction sites in any of the family islands in a little while. But when you talk about new construction sites here in New Providence, it is very clear that the vast majority of them are aimed at the second home market or at Airbnbs or at foreign home ownership. From location to style to even the way the developments are being advertised. I have yet to see a black face on any of these promotional billboards or anything like that for the new home ownership. Well, that's a bit of a lie. It's not that I have yet to see, but the majority of the faces are white, frankly speaking. I mean, there's something to consider here, right? So, a year before Pam wrote, Bill Allen's son, Andrew, wrote a letter in August of 2022 that talked about the repeal of the Immovable Properties Act as part of a suite of neoliberal policies exemplifying the so-called trickle-down effect. And Andrew said that they had obviously failed. And he wrote his letter after Prime Minister Davis asserted that a supposed ideological shift of the Ingram era was the most important challenge to the development of the Bahamas. He argues in his letter that the so-called shift resulted in failed policies and said he hoped the discussion signaled a shift, quote, back towards genuinely progressive economic policies, unquote. Some highlights from Andrew's letter. Business interests, economists, and even government ministries frequently cite rising prices in the foreign second home market as evidence of economic success, even as they concede that middle-class Bahamian professionals now require state assistance to own their first home. Andrew doesn't say this, but I'm adding this. Imagine the lower middle class or lower class, economically speaking, Bahamian families. If the middle class professionals need state assistance. Andrew says that this state of affairs is the result of bad policy undergirded by a failed ideology. He says the repeal of the Immovable Properties Act without the compensation of massively increased property tax receipts was baffling, especially if one considers practice and experience elsewhere. And according to him, any place in the U.S. with a luxury second home market also boasts high and vigorously enforced property taxes, which are in turn pumped into public investment. That is a paradigm that I believe Michael Halkidis would support. But I don't think it is one that is possibly on the table at the moment. And Andrew says that here in the Bahamas, while locals are increasingly priced out, we boast low property taxes, lax enforcement, again, except against locals, and a treasurer that is statutorily barred from seizing delinquent foreign-owned properties, and a cap on property taxes that only benefits properties valued in the tens of millions. What Andrew says is that these quote-unquote regressive features compound rather than balance the negative effects of foreign competition for limited land resources, and together with regressive taxes and austere spending on the population, negate any natural benefit that the industry might confer. In other words, Andrew says, as the floodgates have been opened to foreign ownership of Bahamian land, the industry has been squeezed of any real benefit to the treasury or the domestic economy. It is highly doubtful, he says, whether on balance it is now actually beneficial to the Bahamas at all. Now, Andrew, anyway, I'll leave the rest of his letter alone for the moment because he's talking about his own personal views of Ingram back in the day. And I think that is not really what we're talking about here today. So against the backdrop of those two letters, I want to re-examine what Keith Bell's prescription, for lack of a better word, for dealing with the housing concerns of Bahamians is. And his concern and his prescription for the moment is to quote-unquote review the Rent Control Act. How, if you believe that the problem is foreign ownership of Bahamian land, as I do, I don't see how. Well, let me put it this way. I will I will be very interested to see how reviewing provisions in the Rent Control Act will result in a real effect, let's say, on what is the fundamental problem. Because if you agree, as I do, that the problem is foreign ownership, and the fact that even when Bahamians are building now, they are building with an eye to renting to foreigners rather than selling to Bahamians. And you can tell that by the exorbitant, almost ludicrous prices that they are demanding, and in often, and in infrequent cases, quite able to achieve for their properties. And from a business perspective, I mean, if you could get $3,000 a month for an apartment that 2 years ago cost $1,000, you would almost be a fool not to get the $3,000. And I think that's the problem, right? The problem is that with the provisions in the International Persons Landholding Act, the final arbiter of what is and what is not acceptable is the almighty dollar. And when the wages of the average Bahamian are only growing in the single digits, if they are growing at all, and the fact that they are growing is incredibly positive, don't get me wrong, but if that growth is single digit growth versus double digit growth in land and housing prices at an accelerated rate, in other words, if the rate of the growth of prices for land and housing is faster than the rate of growth for salaries and income, and faster by an order of magnitude, then the paradigm that is currently in place is not only to the detriment of Bahamians, but it will get worse and worse and worse and worse. Pam talked about the fact that Bahamians might become foreigners in their own country. Now, when we talk about that, usually people are talking about immigration. Usually people are saying, oh my God, the Haitians are they're outbreeding us, the Haitians are going to own the country. What? When the Americans and the Canadians and the Brits and the Chinese and the Israelis are buying up all the land, and you're worried about the Haitians having babies? When I started the show today, this is why I was like, I don't really want to talk politics these days for obvious reasons. But I think this is an incredibly important element of our local politics. And it is something that as a community, as a society, we are ignoring to our own detriment. It's okay for us to complain about the rising cost of housing. But until we address the roots of that problem, until we understand what the cause is and what the solutions are, we're just beating up our gums. And I hope that this stream of conversation here on the Sunday Scotch Society is able to shake off some of the scales from our eyes, right? Because this isn't about politics. This is not about FNM and PLP. This is about governance and how we view our own country. This is about what does it mean in the final analysis, what does it mean to be a Bahamian in the Bahamas? Right? in my social media life these last couple of days, you know, and even at the top of the show today, you know, I was talking about the fact that we live in paradise. And we really, really do, ladies and gentlemen. We really, really do. And I hope that Dwight don't beat me up for saying this. But most of us are here living like niggas in paradise. We don't live like people who own this land. We don't live like people who own this country. We live like we don't belong here, like we sneak on this property. Like we trespassing. This paradise is our paradise. Anyway, the Jameson Irish Whiskey is a beautiful standard, and I encourage you strongly to make sure you always have a bottle on hand, because it's a great way to just take a break and enjoy something that tastes good. Especially if you're not a Scotch drinker, the Jameson is a great introduction. It's a great way to get started. That's it for me today. I missed Matthew, but I enjoyed having a chance to chat with you as usual. And we will see you the next time on the Sunday Scotch Society. Ciao, as Mello would say. Ciao, as Matthew would say. And as I like to say, das darovia.
Yeah, yeah.
Check it out.